There are about 10,000 hoplites of the Greeks encamped together, and the Thessalian cavalry joined them. The Lacedaemonian commander was Evenetus, son of Carinus, chosen from among the Polemarchs, though not of the royal line, and the Athenian commander was Themistocles, son of Neocles. They stayed there only a few days, for messengers came from Alexander, son of Amyntas, a Macedonian, advising them to withdraw and not remain in the pass to be trampled by the advancing army, pointing out the size of the force and the number of the ships. When these men gave this advice, since it seemed good advice and the Macedonian appeared well-disposed toward them, they were persuaded. I think, however, that fear was really what persuaded them, when they learned that there was also another pass into Thessaly, through Upper Macedonia by way of the Perihebi, near the city of Gonus, the very pass by which Xerxes' army actually did invade. So the Greeks went down to their ships and returned to the Isthmus. This was the expedition to Thessaly, made while the king was about to cross into Europe from Asia and was already at Abydos. The Thessalians, left without allies, therefore mediated so eagerly and without any hesitation that, as matters unfolded, the king found them exceptionally useful. The Greeks, when they arrived at the Isthmus, deliberated, in light of what Alexander had told them, where they should make their stand for the war and in what places. The prevailing opinion was to guard the pass at Thermopylae, for it seemed narrower than the one into Thessaly and at the same time closer to their own territory. As for the path by which those Greeks who were captured at Thermopylae were caught, they did not even know it existed until, arriving at Thermopylae, they learned of it from the people of Trachis. This pass, then, they resolved to guard so as not to let the barbarian through into Greece, while the naval force would sail along the coast of the Hisaean territory to Artemisium. These places are close enough to each other that news of events at either could be learned, given how the locations lie. As for Artemisium, from the wide Thracian Sea, it narrows into the strait between the island of Scythos and the mainland of Magnesia. And from that strait, the coast of Euboea beyond receives Artemisium, where there is a temple of Artemis. As for the entrance into Greece through Trachis, it is half a plethron wide at its narrowest. This, however, is not the narrowest part of that whole region. There is a place narrower still both before Thermopylae and behind it, at Alpini behind it, where there is only a single wagon track, and in front near the river Phoenix, close to the city of Anthel, another single wagon track. Of Thermopylae, the mountain on the western side is impassable and sheer, high, rising up to Oda. On the eastern side of the road, the sea and marshes take over. In this pass, there are hot springs, which the locals call the pots, and an altar of Heracles has been set up beside them. A wall had been built across this pass, and in ancient times there were gates there as well. The Phocians built the wall out of fear when the Thessalians came from the Sprotia to settle the land of Ialis, which they now hold. Since the Thessalians were trying to subdue them, the Phocians took this precaution beforehand, and they also let loose the hot water then upon the entrance, so that the place would be gullied out, doing everything they could arrange matters so the Thessalians would not invade their territory. The old wall dated from long ago, and by this time most of it had crumbled with age, but those who rebuilt it resolved to defend Greece from the barbarian at that spot. The village nearest the road is called Alpini. From this the Greeks reckoned they would get their provisions. These places, then, seemed suitable to the Greeks, for having considered everything and reckoned that the barbarians would be unable to use either their numbers or their cavalry there, they decided to make their stand there against the invader of Greece. Once word reached them that the Persian king was in Pyria, they left the Isthmus and departed, some marching by land to Thermopylae, others going by sea to Artemisium. So the Greeks hastened to help, divided into these two groups. Meanwhile, the Delphians, in fear for themselves and for Greece, consulted the gods' oracle and were told to pray to the winds, for these would prove great allies to Greece. Having received this oracle, the Delphians first announced what had been prophesied to them to those Greeks who wished to be free, and by announcing it to men terribly afraid of the barbarian, they earned undying gratitude. After this, the Delphians set up an altar to the winds at Theia, where the precinct of Theia, daughter of Cephisus, is from whom this place also takes its name, and they propitiated them with sacrifices. And to this day the Delphians, in accordance with that oracle, still propitiate the winds. Xerxes' naval force, setting out from the city of Therma, sent 10 of its best sailing ships straight for Skiathros, where three Greek ships were keeping watch, one from Trozen, one from Aegina, and one from Athens. When these caught sight of the barbarians' ships, they fled. The Trozenian ship, commanded by Proxenus, was overtaken and captured at once by the barbarians, and then, of the marines aboard her, they took the handsomest man, led him to the prow of the ship, and cut his throat, taking it as a good omen that the first and finest of the Greeks they had captured should be sacrificed this way. The name of the man sacrificed was Leon, and perhaps the name itself had something to do with it. The Aeginetan ship, whose captain was Asonides, gave them some trouble because of Pythia's son of Ischinus, a marine aboard her who proved himself the finest man that day. For when the ship was being captured, he held out fighting until he had been hacked entirely to pieces. Since he fell but did not die, and still breathed, the Persians who served as marines on the ships on account of his valor took the greatest pains to save him, treating his wounds with myrrh and binding them with strips of fine linen. And when they got back to their own camp, they displayed him to the whole army with admiration, treating him well. But the rest of the men they had taken from that ship they treated as slaves. So two of the three ships were captured in this way. The third, commanded by Formus, an Athenian, ran aground fleeing at the mouth of the Peneus, and the barbarians got possession of the hull, but not of the men, for as soon as the Athenians had beached the ship, they leapt out and made their way through Thessaly back to Athens. The Greeks stationed at Artemisium learned of this from fire signals sent from Skiathros, and on learning it, in fear, they moved their anchorage from Artemisium to Chalcis, meaning to guard the Euripus, but leaving day watchers on the high places of Euboea. Of the 10 barbarian ships, three ran up onto the reef lying between Skiathros and Magnesia, called the Ant. There the barbarians, once they had brought a stone pillar and set it up on the reef, set out themselves from Therma, now that the obstacle in their path had been marked clear, and sailed on with all their ships, 11 days after the king's departure from Therma. The reef in the channel was pointed out to them chiefly by Pammon of Syros. Sailing the whole day, the barbarians reached the region of Magnesia at Sepias and the stretch of shore between the city of Castania and the headland of Sepias. Up to this point, and as far as Thermopylae, the army had suffered no misfortune, and its numbers at that time were still, as I reckon by calculation, such as follows. Of the ships from Asia, 1,207 in total. The complement originally drawn from each nation totaled 241,400 men, figuring 200 men per ship. Aboard these ships, apart from each contingent's own local marines, there also served, of Persians, Medes, and Sacchi, 30 men each. This other body comes to 36,210. I will add further to this and to the previous number the men from the 50-oared ships, reckoning, whether more or fewer served on them, an average of 80 men each. These vessels, as was said before, numbered 3,000. So the men aboard them would be 240,000. This, then, was the naval force from Asia, amounting in total to 517,610. The infantry came to 1,700,000, and the cavalry to 80,000. I will add further to these the camel-riding Arabians and the Libyans who drove chariots, putting their number at 20,000. And so the total from the ships and the infantry together comes to 2,317,610. This is the count of the force brought out from Asia itself, apart from the attendants following it, and the supply vessels, and all who sailed in them. But the force brought from Europe still has to be added to this whole, some already reckoned, though here one must speak by estimate. The Greeks from Thrace and from the islands lying off Thrace supplied 120 ships. From these ships, the men come to 24,000. As for infantry, the Thracians, Paeonians, Aerdians, Bocchians, the Chalcidian people, Brygians, Pyrians, Macedonians, Perhebians, Aenianians, Dolopians, Magnesians, Achaeans, and all who inhabit the coast of Thrace supplied, I reckon, 300,000 men from these nations. These, added to those from Asia, make in all 2,641,660 fighting men. Given that the fighting force amounted to this number, I do not suppose that the attendants following them, and those aboard the supply boats and the other vessels sailing along with the army, were fewer than the fighting men, but rather more. Still, I will reckon them as equal to that number, neither more nor fewer. Made equal to the fighting force in this way, they fill out the same number again. Thus Xerxes son of Darius led 5,283,220 men as far as Sepias and Thermopylae. This then is the number of Xerxes' entire force. But of the women who baked the bread, the concubines, and the eunuchs, no one could give an accurate count, nor again of the pack animals and other beasts of burden and the Indian dogs that followed. No one could give a number for these either, owing to their multitude. So it is no wonder to me that the streams of certain rivers failed, but rather it is a wonder to me how the provisions held out for so vast a multitude. For I find by calculation that if each man received 1 chonix of wheat a day and no more, 110,000 medimni would be used up each day, plus another 340 medimni. And I am not even reckoning for the women, eunuchs, pack animals, and dogs. Of men there being so many tens of thousands, in beauty and stature none among them was more deserving to hold that power than Xerxes himself. As for the fleet, after setting out and sailing until it reached the Magnesian coast, in the stretch lying between Castania and Cape Sepias, the leading vessels anchored nearest the shore, while others lay at anchor farther out behind them. For since the shore was not large, they lay anchored in rows out to sea, 8 ships deep. So they spent that night. But at dawn, out of a clear and windless sky, the sea began to seethe, and a great storm fell on them along with a strong east wind, which the people living in those parts call the Hellespontian. Those of them who noticed the wind rising and where their ships lay anchored got ahead of the storm by hauling their ships up onto land, and both they and their ships survived. But as for those ships the storm caught out at sea, it carried some to the place called the Ovens on Pelion, others onto the shore. Some were wrecked around Sepias itself, others driven onto the city of Melibea, and others cast up at Castania. The violence of the storm was unbearable. It is said that the Athenians had invoked Boreas by an oracle, after another oracle had come to them telling them to call on their son-in-law for help. Boreas, according to the Greek account, has an Attic wife, Orithia, daughter of Erechtheus. On account of this marriage connection, the Athenians, as the story goes, reckoning Boreas to be their son-in-law, when they were stationed with their fleet at Chalcis in Euboea, and saw the storm rising, or even before that, offered sacrifices and invoked Boreas and Orithia to help them and wreck the barbarian ships, as had occurred earlier near Athos. I cannot say whether this was actually why Boreas struck the barbarians while they were anchored, but the Athenians themselves say that Boreas had helped them before and accomplished this too, and on returning home, they founded a shrine to Boreas beside the river Ilissus. In this disaster, it is said that no fewer than 400 ships were destroyed, along with countless men and an abundance of wealth beyond counting. As a result, this shipwreck proved a great boon to Aminocles, son of Cretans, a Magnesian who owned land around Sepias, for he picked up many gold cups washed ashore later, and many silver ones, found treasures belonging to the Persians, and acquired other untold wealth besides. Yet though he grew very rich from these finds, he was not fortunate in everything else, for a bitter misfortune, the loss of a child, also grieved him. As for the destruction of the grain-carrying merchant vessels and the other ships, there was no counting them. So fearing that the Thessalians would attack them while they were in this crippled state, the commanders of the naval force built a high barrier out of the wreckage, for the storm raged for 3 days. At last, by performing sacrifices and having the Magi chant incantations to the wind, and by sacrificing further to Thetis and the Nereids besides, they brought it to an end on the 4th day, or else it simply died down of its own accord. They sacrificed to Thetis because they had learned the story from the Ionians, that Peleus had seized her from this very spot, and that the entire headland called Sepias was hers, shared with the rest of the Nereids. The storm ceased on the 4th day. As for the Greeks, their lookouts, hurrying down from the Euboean heights on the 2nd day since the storm began, brought word of everything that had happened concerning the shipwreck. When the Greeks learned of it, they prayed to Poseidon the Savior and poured libations, then hurried back as fast as they could to Artemisium, expecting to find only a few enemy ships left to face. They came a 2nd time to Artemisium and anchored there, and from that time to this, they have honored Poseidon under the title Savior. As for the barbarians, once the wind died down and the swell had settled, they hauled down their ships and sailed along the mainland. And after passing the Magnesian Cape, they sailed directly toward the gulf leading to Pagasi. Within this gulf, in Magnesia, lies a spot where, according to tradition, Jason and his fellow voyagers on the Argo abandoned Heracles after sending him to fetch water, when they were sailing for the fleece to Ea and Colchis, for it was from there that they intended to draw water before setting out onto the open sea. From this, the place has taken the name of Fetty. It was here, then, that Xerxes's fleet made anchorage. 15 of these ships happened to put out very much later than the rest, and somehow caught sight of the Greek ships at Artemisium. The barbarians thought these were their own ships, and sailing on, fell in among the enemy. In command of them was Sandoces, son of Thymasius, the governor from Syme in Aeolis, whom King Darius had earlier arrested on the following charge and had impaled, he being one of the royal judges. Sandoces had given an unjust verdict for money. After he had been hung up on the stake, Darius, reckoning it over, found that he had done more good than harm for the royal house, and having found this, and recognizing that he himself had acted more hastily than wisely, Darius released him. So it was that he had escaped death at the hands of King Darius and survived. But now, having sailed against the Greeks, he was not going to escape a second time. For when the Greeks spotted them approaching, they recognized the enemy's blunder, sailed out to meet them, and seized them with ease. On one of these ships was captured Eridales, tyrant of Alabanda in Caria, who was sailing in it. On another was the Paphian commander Penthalus, son of Demenus, who had brought 12 ships from Paphos, only to lose 11 when the storm struck near Sepias, and was captured while sailing the sole survivor toward Artemisium. The Greeks questioned these men, learning from them what they wished to know about Xerxes's army, and then sent them off in bonds to the Isthmus of Corinth. So the barbarians' naval force, apart from the 15 ships whose commander I said was Sandoces, arrived at Aphetti. Xerxes and the land army, meanwhile, had marched through Thessaly and Achaia and had already, on the third day, invaded the country of the Malians, having held in Thessaly a horse race in which he tested both his own horses and the Thessalian horses, having learned that these were the best in Greece. And there the Greek horses were left far behind. Of the rivers in Thessaly, only the Onychonus did not suffice with its flow to supply the army's drinking, and of the rivers flowing in Achaia, not even the Epidanus, the largest of them, held out except barely. When Xerxes had come to Eleusis in Achaia, his guides, wishing to explain everything, told him a local story concerning the sanctuary of Laphystian Zeus, how Athamas son of Aeolus, together with Ino, plotted death for Phrixus, and how afterward, by an oracle's command, the Achaeans imposed these ordeals on his descendants. Whoever is the eldest of that family is barred by the others, who set a watch on him, from entering the town hall. The Achaeans call the town hall the Leighton. If he enters, there is no way he can leave again except when he is about to be sacrificed. And indeed many of those who were about to be sacrificed have already fled in fear to another country, and, when time has passed, if they return and are caught, they are led to the town hall. There they describe how the man is sacrificed, wreathed all over with garlands, and led out in a procession. This is what happens to the descendants of Cytosaurus, son of Phrixus, because when the Achaeans, following an oracle, were purifying the land and were about to sacrifice Athamas, son of Aeolus, this Cytosaurus arrived from Ea in Colchis and rescued him, and by doing this, he brought down the god's wrath upon his own descendants. When Xerxes heard this, as he came near the sacred grove, he himself kept away from it and gave the same order to his whole army, and he showed the same reverence to the house and precinct of Athamas's descendants. Such were the events in Thessaly and in Achaia. From these regions he went on into Mali's, along a gulf of the sea where an ebb and flow occurs every day. Around this gulf there is a flat area, in places broad, in others quite narrow, and around this area lie high impassable mountains that enclose the whole land of Mali's, called the Trachinian Rocks. The first city one comes to in this gulf, coming from Achaia, is Antisira, beside which the river Spercheius flows down from the Aeneans and empties into the sea. From there, about 20 stads on, is another river called the Dirus, which legend says appeared to aid Heracles as he was burning. From there, another 20 stads on, is another river called the Melas. The city of Trachis is 5 stads from this river Melas. It is here, where Trachis is built, that this whole region is widest from the mountains to the sea, for the plain measures 22,000 plethra. The mountain range enclosing Trachinian territory has a gorge south of the town of Trachis, and the Asopus River runs through this gorge, following the base of the mountain. There is also another river, the Phoenix, not large, to the south of the Asopus, which flows down from these mountains and empties into the Asopus. At the Phoenix River, the pass is at its narrowest. A single wagon track has been built there. From the River Phoenix, it is 15 stads to Thermopylae. Between the River Phoenix and Thermopylae, there is a village called Anthel, past which the Asopus flows on its way to empty into the sea, and there is a broad space around it, in which a temple to Demeter Amphictyonus is located, along with council seats for the Amphictyons and a shrine to Amphictyon himself. King Xerxes made his camp in the Trachinian part of Mali's, while the Greeks made theirs in the pass. This place is called Thermopylae by most Greeks, but Pylae by the local people and their neighbors. Each side, then, made camp in these places, and each controlled the ground on its own side. Xerxes everything to the north as far as Trachis, the Greeks everything to the south, and toward the mainland on this side. The Greeks who awaited the Persian in this place were the following: 300 Spartan hoplites, and 1,000 from Tegea and Mantinea, half from each, and from Orchomenus in Arcadia sent 120 men, while the remainder of Arcadia supplied 1,000 more, that was the Arcadian total. Corinth contributed 400, Phlius 200, and Mycenae 80. These came from the Peloponnese. From Boeotia came 700 Thespians and 400 Thebans. In addition to these, the Opuntian Locrians came in full force when summoned, along with 1,000 Phocians. For the Greeks themselves had called on them, sending word by messengers that they themselves had come ahead as a vanguard of the rest, that the remaining allies were expected any day, that the sea was under guard, watched over by the Athenians, the Aeginetans, and those assigned to the fleet, and that there was nothing to fear. For it was not a god who was advancing upon Greece but merely a man, and no mortal had ever lived, nor ever would, entirely free of misfortune from birth onward. Indeed, the greatest men bore the greatest share of it. So the one now advancing, being mortal himself, was bound to fall from his high repute. Hearing this, the Greeks went to the aid of Trachis. Now among them there were commanders from each city individually, but the man most admired, and who commanded the entire force, was the Lacedaemonian Leonidas, descended, father to son, from Anaxandrides, Leon, Eurycratides, Anaxander, Eurycrates, Polydorus, Alcamenes, Telecles, Archelaus, Hegesilaus, Dorisus, Leobotes, Echestratus, Auges, Eurysthenes, Aristodemus, Aristomachus, Cleodius, Hyllus, and Heracles, who had come to hold the kingship at Sparta quite unexpectedly. For since he had two elder brothers, Cleomenes and Dorius, he had put the thought of the kingship out of his mind. But when Cleomenes died, leaving no male child, and Dorius was no longer living either, having also died in Sicily, the kingship passed in this way to Leonidas, and because he was older than Cleombrotus, since Cleombrotus was the youngest son of Anaxandrides, and moreover he was married to the daughter of Cleomenes. He it was who then went to Thermopylae, having chosen the men enrolled as the standing 300 and those among them who happened to have sons. And on his way, he took along also the Thebans I mentioned in reckoning the number, whose commander was Leontiades, son of Eurymachus. Leonidas was eager to bring these men, of all the Greeks, along with him for this reason, that they were strongly accused of favoring the Medes. He therefore summoned them to the war, wanting to know whether they would openly send reinforcements or openly refuse the Greek alliance. The Spartans, their minds elsewhere, kept sending men anyway. They sent the men with Leonidas out first, so that the rest of the allies, seeing them, would take the field and not, on hearing that the Spartans were putting things off, also go over to the Medes. Later on, once they had kept the festival of the Carnia, which stood in their way, and had left garrisons behind in Sparta, they intended to come to help with the whole army and with all speed. So too the rest of the allies had decided to act likewise, since it happened that the Olympic festival coincided with these events, and since they did not expect the conflict at Thermopylae to be settled so fast, they sent only advance troops. These, then, had resolved to act in this way. As for the Greeks at Thermopylae, when the Persian drew near the pass, they grew afraid and took counsel about withdrawing. It was the view of the rest of the Peloponnesians that they should go back into the Peloponnese and hold the isthmus under guard. But Leonidas, since the Phocians and Locrians were indignant at this plan, voted to stay there himself and to send messengers to the cities urging them to send help, on the ground that they were too few to ward off the army of the Medes. While they were debating this, Xerxes sent a horseman as a scout to see how many they were and what they were doing. He had heard, while still in Thessaly, that a small force had gathered there, and that its leaders were the Lacedaemonians together with Leonidas, who was of the line of Heracles. When the horseman rode up to the camp, he looked and observed it, though not the whole camp, for those posted inside the wall which they had restored and were guarding, he could not make out, but he took note of those outside, whose arms lay in front of the wall. At that time it happened that the Lacedaemonians were posted outside. Some of the men he saw exercising, others combing their hair. Watching this, he was amazed and took note of their number as well. Having learned everything precisely, he rode back at his leisure, for no one pursued him, and he met with a great deal of indifference. When he came back, he told Xerxes everything he had seen. Hearing this, Xerxes could not grasp the truth of it, that they were preparing to die and to kill as best they could. But since what they were doing seemed absurd to him, he sent for Demaratus, son of Ariston, who was in the camp. When he arrived, Xerxes questioned him closely about all this, wanting to understand what the Lacedaemonians were doing. Demaratus said, "You heard me before when we were setting out for Greece, speaking about these men, and when you heard me, you made me a laughingstock for saying how I saw these matters turning out. Yet for me, striving to speak the truth before you, O king, is the greatest of contests. Hear me now as well. These men have come to fight us for the passage, and that is what they are preparing for. It is their custom, when they are about to risk their lives, to groom their heads. Know this, if you subdue these men and the force remaining behind in Sparta, there is no other nation of men on earth that will withstand you, O king, and raise its hands against you. For now you are approaching the kingdom and the finest city among the Greeks and the best men." To Xerxes, what was said seemed utterly incredible, and he asked further how, being so few, they would fight against his army. Demaratus said, "O king, treat me as a liar if this does not turn out for you just as I say." Saying this, he did not persuade Xerxes. For 4 days he let them be, still expecting that they would run off at any moment. But on the fifth day, when they had not withdrawn, but seemed to him to be persisting out of sheer insolence and folly, he grew angry and sent the Medes and Scythians against them, ordering them to take them alive and bring them into his presence. When the Medes fell upon the Greeks and charged, many of them fell, but others came on in their place, and they were not driven back, even though they were suffering great losses. They made it plain to everyone, and not least to the king himself, that there were many men there but few real fighters. The engagement went on all day. When the Medes were being roughly handled, they then withdrew, and the Persians took their place and came on, those the king called the immortals, whom Hydarnes commanded, thinking that they at least would easily finish the task. But when these two closed with the Greeks, they gained nothing more than the Median force had, but the same result, since they were fighting in a narrow place and using shorter spears than the Greeks, and could not make use of their numbers. The Lacedaemonians fought in a manner worth recounting, showing themselves skilled in fighting against men unskilled in it in various ways, and whenever they turned their backs, closing ranks they would pretend to flee, and the barbarians, seeing them flee, would come on with shouting and clatter. But the Greeks, once overtaken, would wheel about to face the barbarians, and turning back on them would cut down countless numbers of the Persians. A few of the Spartans themselves fell there as well. Since the Persians, trying by companies and in every way to force their way through the entrance, could gain nothing, they withdrew. During these approaches in the battle, it is said that the king, watching, leapt up 3 times from his throne in fear for his army. So they fought that day, and on the next the barbarians did no better. For since they were few, expecting them to be wounded already and no longer able to raise their hands against them, they joined battle. But the Greeks were arranged in ranks and by nations, and each contingent fought in its turn, except the Phocians. These had been posted on the mountain to guard the path. When the Persians found nothing different from what they had seen the day before, they withdrew. While the king was at a loss what to do about the situation before him, Ephialt, son of Eurydmus, a man of Mollys, came to speak with him. Thinking to win a great reward from the king, He told him of the path leading over the mountain to Thermopylae, and thereby brought about the destruction of the Greeks who had held out there. Later, fearing the Lacedaemonians, he fled to Thessaly. And while he was in exile, a price was put on his head by the Pylagorae of the Amphictyons when they had gathered at the Pylia. Some time afterward, when he had come down to Antisira, he was killed by Athenades, a man of Trachis. This Athenades killed Ephialtes for another reason, which I shall explain later in my account, yet he was honored by the Lacedaemonians no less for it. Ephialtes, then, died later in this way. But there is another account given, that once son of Phanagoras, Acharistion, and Corydalus of Antisira were the ones who told the king these things and guided the Persians around the mountain, an account which to me is in no way credible. For one must reckon this, that the leaders of the Greeks, the Pylagorae, put a price not on once in Corydalus but on Ephialtes of Trachis, having surely learned the truth of the matter as exactly as possible. And this too, that we know Ephialtes fled on this very charge. Once might indeed have known this path even without being a Malian, if he had had much dealing with the region. But since it was Ephialtes who guided them around the mountain by the path, it is he whom I name as responsible. Xerxes, since what Ephialtes promised to accomplish pleased him, was overjoyed at once and sent Hydarnes, and Hydarnes led the force he commanded. They set out from the camp about the time the lamps are lit. This path had been discovered by the local people of Males, who upon discovering it had guided the Thessalians against the Phocians, at the time when the Phocians had walled off the pass and were under shelter from the war. And from that time it had been known, being of no use to the Malians. This path runs as follows. It begins at the river Asopus, which flows through the ravine, and the mountain and the path bear the same name, Anapia. This Anapia runs along the ridge of the mountain and ends at the city of Alpenus, the first of the Locrian towns as one comes from Males, and by the rock called Melampigus and the seats of the Cercopes, where the path is narrowest. Along this path, being such as it is, the Persians, having crossed the Asopus, marched the whole night, with the mountains of the Otians on their right and those of Trachis on their left. Dawn was just breaking when they reached the summit of the mountain. At this point of the mountain, there kept guard, as I have said before, 1,000 Phocian hoplites, defending their own territory and guarding the path. The lower pass was guarded by those already mentioned, but the path over the mountain was guarded at their own request by the Phocians, who had undertaken this for Leonidas. The Phocians became aware of them coming up in this way. The Persians, in climbing, went unnoticed, the whole mountain being covered with oak trees. There was no wind, but as was natural, a great deal of noise arose from the leaves scattered underfoot, so the Phocians sprang up and put on their arms, and at once the barbarians were upon them. When they saw men putting on armor, they were struck with astonishment, for expecting no one to appear opposed to them, they had run into an army. At this Hydarnes, fearing that the Phocians might be Lacedaemonians, asked Ephialtes what people the force was, and learning the truth precisely, he drew up the Persians for battle. The Phocians, as they were struck by the arrows, many and thick, fled to the top of the mountain, thinking that they had been the original target of the attack and prepared themselves to be destroyed. This was their thinking, but the Persians under Ephialtes and Hydarnes paid the Phocians no further attention and instead went down the mountain with all speed. As for the Greeks at Thermopylae, first the seer Megistus, looking into the sacred offerings, declared what was about to happen out of their death at dawn, and in addition there were deserters from among the Persians who reported the going around march. These men brought their report while night still held. Third came the day watchers, hurrying down from the heights as daylight began to break. At this point the Greeks took counsel, and their opinions were divided. Some said they should not abandon their position, while others argued against this. After this, once they had split apart, some went their separate ways and, scattering, each turned toward their own city, while others of them made ready to stay there with Leonidas. It is said, too, that Leonidas himself sent them away, out of concern that they not perish, but that for himself and the Spartans present, it was not fitting to abandon the post they had come to guard from the start. To this view I myself most incline, that Leonidas, when he perceived that the allies were without enthusiasm and unwilling to share the danger, ordered them to withdraw, but that for himself to leave was not honorable. For if he stayed, great glory would be his, and Sparta's prosperity would remain intact. The Pythia had in fact prophesied to the Spartans, when they first sought her counsel about this war at its outset, that either the barbarians would lay Laestemon waste, or their king would perish. This she declared to them in hexameter verses, speaking as follows. For you, dwellers in wide-wayed Sparta, either your great and glorious city will be sacked by men of Perseus's line, or, if not that, then the borderland of Laestemon will mourn a king dead, one from the stock of Heracles. For the might of bulls nor of lions will not hold him back in resistance, for he has the might of Zeus, and I say he will not be held back until he has utterly torn apart one or the other of these two. Reflecting on this, and wishing to lay up fame for the Spartans alone, Leonidas sent away the allies rather than have those who went depart in such disorder, because of a difference of opinion. And no small proof of this, in my view, has come to me in this, that even the seer who accompanied this army, Megistus the Acarnanian, said to be descended in his lineage from Melampus. This man, after declaring from the sacrificial signs what was going to befall them, is plainly seen to have been sent away by Leonidas, so that he might not perish along with them. But he, though sent away, did not himself leave. Instead, he sent away his son, who was serving in the campaign with him and was his only child. So then the allies who were sent away departed and obeyed Leonidas, but the Thespians and the Thebans alone remained behind with the Lacedaemonians. Of these, the Thebans remained unwillingly and against their will, for Leonidas held them back, treating them as hostages. But the Thespians remained willingly, to the highest degree, for they refused to abandon Leonidas and those with him and depart, but stayed and died together with them. Their general was Demophilus, son of Diadromes. Xerxes, after making libations at sunrise, waited a while, until about the time the marketplace fills up, and then began his advance, for it had been so instructed by Ephialtes. For the descent from the mountain is more direct, and the distance much shorter than the circuit and the ascent. So the barbarians around Xerxes advanced, and the Greeks around Leonidas, since they were now making their sortie as men going out to death, advanced much further than before into the wider part of the pass. For the defensive wall had been guarded on the earlier days, and they had gone out into the narrow passage to fight. But this time, fighting in the open ground beyond the narrows, vast numbers of the barbarians died. Behind the ranks, their officers gripped whips and lashed every man, constantly forcing them onward. Many of them fell into the sea and perished, and far more still were trampled alive by one another. There was no accounting for the dying. For since they knew the death that was coming to them from those going around the mountain, they displayed as much strength as they had against the barbarians, as men reckless of their lives and driven to desperation. By this time, most of their spears happened to be broken, and they were dispatching the Persians with their swords. And in this struggle Leonidas fell, having proven himself a man of the greatest excellence, and with him other Spartans of note, whose names I have learned, being men worthy of it, and I have learned the names of all 300 as well. And there too fell many notable Persians, among them two sons of Darius, Abrocums and Hyperanthes, born to Darius by Phratagune, daughter of Artines. This Artines was brother of King Darius, being the son of Hystaspes, son of Arsames. And when he gave his daughter in marriage to Darius, he bestowed his entire estate upon him as well, since she was his only child. So it was that two of Xerxes's brothers died in the fighting, and a fierce struggle broke out over Leonidas's body between the Persians and the Lacedaemonians, until the Greeks by their valor dragged it away and turned back their opponents four times. This went on until those with Ephialtes arrived. When the Greeks learned that these had come, from that point the character of the fight changed. They withdrew back into the narrow part of the road, and passing beyond the wall, they went and took their stand on the hillock, all of them gathered together except the Thebans. This hillock is at the entrance, where the stone lion now stands in honor of Leonidas. In this spot, defending themselves with daggers, those of them who still had any left, and with hands and teeth, they were buried under missiles by the barbarians pelting them, some coming on from the front and having demolished the defensive wall, and others having come around and surrounded them on every side. Though the Lacedaemonians and Thespians were in such straits, it is nevertheless said that the bravest man was a Spartan, Dinex, and he is said to have spoken these words before engaging the Medes, after a man from Track Eyes told him that when the barbarians loosed their arrows, the sheer mass of shafts blotted out the sun. So vast was their number. But he, not at all dismayed by this, unfazed by this news, dismissed the size of the Median host and said the Trachinian stranger's report was all good news, since if the Medes blocked out the sun, the fight would take place in shade rather than under the blazing sun. This remark, along with other similar ones, is said to be what Dinex the Lacedaemonian left behind as his memorial. Following him, two Lacedaemonian brothers are said to have excelled, Alpheus and Maron, sons of Orsiphantus. Of the Thespians, the one who won the greatest fame was a man named Dithyrambus, son of Harmatides. They were buried there where they fell, and for them, along with those who had died earlier, before those sent away by Leonidas had departed, there is inscribed this writing: "Here once against 300 myriads fought 4,000 men from the Peloponnese." This inscription is for all of them together, and there is a separate one for the Spartans in particular. "O stranger, tell the Lacedaemonians that here we lie, obedient to their words. This is for the Lacedaemonians, and this other for the seer. This is the monument of famous Megistus, whom once the Medes slew after crossing the river Spurcius, a seer who, though he knew clearly the fates coming upon him, could not bear to abandon the leader of Sparta. Now with these inscriptions and pillars, apart from the inscription for the seer, it was the Amphictyons who honored them with these adornments. But the inscription for the seer Megistus was written by Simonides, son of Leopreps, out of guest friendship. Of these 300, it is said that two, Eurytus and Aristodemus, though it was possible for them, having agreed together, either to make their way back safely together to Sparta, since Leonidas had in fact released them from the camp, and they lay at Alpeni with an eye disease at its worst stage, or, if they did not wish to return home, to die together with the others, chose not to act in agreement with either of these courses, but instead, differing in judgment, Eurytus, upon learning of the Persians' flanking march, called for his weapons, armed himself, and instructed his helot to guide him to the combatants. Once the helot had brought him there, the helot fled, while Eurytus himself plunged into the throng and was killed, while Aristodemus, being faint of spirit, was left behind. Now, if either Aristodemus alone had returned home to Sparta suffering from his ailment, or if both of them together had made their way back, it seems to me that the Spartans would not have laid up any resentment against them. But as it was, since one of them had perished, and the other, clinging to the same excuse, was unwilling to die, it was inevitable that they should feel great resentment toward Aristodemus. Some then say that Aristodemus was saved and returned to Sparta by this excuse. Others say that a message had brought him from the camp on this errand, and that although it was possible for him to arrive back in time to catch the battle taking place, he was unwilling to do so, but stayed behind on the road and so survived, while his fellow messenger, who did arrive at the battle, was killed. When Aristodemus returned home to Laestemon, he had reproach and dishonor, and he suffered dishonor of this kind. No Spartan would kindle fire for him nor speak with him. He bore the reproach of being called Aristodemus the Trembler. But he, in the battle at Plataea, redeemed entirely the blame that had been laid upon him. It is also said that another man, sent as messenger to Thessaly, survived from these 300, whose name was Pantites. And when he returned to Sparta, since he had been dishonored, he hanged himself. The Thebans, whom Leontiades commanded, for a time fought alongside the Greeks against the king's army, being held to it by necessity. Yet once it became clear the Persian cause was winning out, then, while the Greeks with Leonidas were hurrying to the hillock, they broke away from them and, stretching out their hands, went closer to the barbarians, telling the truest of the accounts that they had indeed medized and had among the first given earth and water to the king, and that it was under compulsion that they had come to Thermopylae and were blameless for the harm that had come to the king. So by saying this they survived, for they had the Thessalians as witnesses to these claims. Not everything, however, went well for them, for as the barbarians took them when they arrived, some of them they killed, some as they approached, but the greater part of them, at Xerxes' command, they branded with the royal marks, beginning with their general Leontiades, whose son Eurymachus was killed years afterward by the Plataeans, after he had led 400 Thebans as general and taken the city of Plataea. So the Greeks at Thermopylae fought their fight, and Xerxes, summoning Demaratus, began questioning him thus. Demaratus, you are a good man. I judge this from the truth of it, for everything you told me has turned out just so. Now tell me, how many Lacedaemonians are left, and how many of them are of this quality in war, or are they all such? He said, O king, the whole body of Lacedaemonians numbers a great many, spread across many cities. But as for what you wish to learn, you shall know it. There is in Laestimon a city, Sparta, of men about 8,000, and all these are equal to those who fought here. The rest of the Lacedaemonians are not their equal, though they too are good men. To this Xerxes said, Demaratus, by what means might we most easily overcome these men? Come, explain, for you know the outcome of their plans, having been their king yourself. He answered, O king, if indeed you are earnestly asking my counsel, it is right that I tell you the best course, that you send 300 ships of your naval force against the Laconian land. There lies off it an island called Cythera, which Chilon, a man among us of the greatest wisdom, said would be a greater gain for the Spartiates if it were sunk beneath the sea than if it stood above it, always expecting from it something such as I am now explaining to you, not that he foresaw your expedition, but fearing every expedition of men alike. Setting out from this island, let your forces terrify the Lacedaemonians. With a war of their own so close at hand, they will have no fear of coming to the aid of the rest of Greece when it is being conquered by your land forces. And once the rest of Greece has been enslaved, the Laconian power will be left weak and alone. But if you do not do this, expect the following to happen. There is a narrow isthmus of the Peloponnese. In that place, with all the Peloponnesians sworn together against you, expect other battles stronger than those that have already occurred. But if you do as I say, that isthmus and the cities will come over to you without a fight. After him spoke Achaemenes, who was Xerxes' brother and general of the naval force, who happened to be present at this speech, and fearing that Xerxes might be persuaded to do this, said, O king, I see you listening to the words of a man who envies your good fortune, or else is even betraying your affairs. For indeed the Greeks delight in behaving in such ways. They envy good fortune and hate what is stronger than themselves. If, in the present circumstances, in which 400 ships have been wrecked, you send off another 300 from the camp to sail around the Peloponnese, your opponents become a match for you. But while the naval force remains together as a whole, it is difficult for the enemy to handle, and to begin with they will be no match for you at all, and the whole navy will support the army and the army the navy as they proceed together. But if you split them apart, neither will you be of use to them, nor they to you. My opinion is that, if you manage your own affairs well, you need not concern yourself with what your opponents will do, where they will make their stand in war, what they will do, or how many they are, for they themselves are capable enough of looking after their own affairs, and we likewise of ours. As for the Lacedaemonians, if they come out against the Persians to battle, they will not heal the wound already inflicted on them. Xerxes answered him thus, Achaemenes, you seem to me to speak well, and I will do as you say. Demaratus speaks what he believes to be best for me, yet in judgment he is bested by you. For I will not accept this, that he is not well disposed toward my affairs, judging both by what he has said before and weighing it against the facts, that a citizen envies a fellow citizen who is prospering and is hostile to him even in silence. And a citizen would not, even if consulted by a fellow citizen, advise him of what seems to him the best course, unless he has attained to a high degree of virtue, and such men are rare. But a guest friend is most well disposed of all toward a guest friend who is prospering, and if consulted would give the best advice. So then, I bid everyone hereafter refrain from speaking ill of Demaratus, since he is my guest friend. Having said this, Xerxes passed through the dead, and having heard that Leonidas had been king and general of the Lacedaemonians, he ordered that his head be cut off and set on a stake. To me, it is clear from many other pieces of evidence, and not least from this one, that King Xerxes was more enraged at Leonidas while he lived than at any other man, for he would never have committed such an outrage against a corpse, since the Persians, more than any other people I know, are accustomed to honor men who are brave in war. Those who had been ordered to do this did so. I now return to that point in my account where I earlier left off. The Lacedaemonians learned that the king was setting out against Greece before anyone else, and so they dispatched envoys to the Delphic Oracle, where indeed the response was given to them which I mentioned a little earlier. and they learned it in a remarkable way. Demaratus, son of Ariston, who had fled to the Medes, was not, as I believe and as probability also supports me, well disposed toward the Lacedaemonians, and one may guess whether he did what he did out of good will or out of malicious pleasure. For when Xerxes had resolved to march against Greece, Demaratus, who was in Susa and had learned of this, wished to send word of it to the Lacedaemonians. He had no other way to signal it, since there was danger that he would be caught, so he devised the following scheme. Taking a folding writing tablet, he scraped off its wax, and then wrote the king's plan on the wood of the tablet itself. Having done this, he covered the writing again with a fresh coat of wax, so that the blank-looking tablet, once carried off, would cause no trouble from the guards of the road. When it arrived at Laestamon, the Lacedaemonians could not make sense of it, until, as I learn, Gorgo, daughter of Cleomenes and wife of Leonidas, worked it out herself and suggested to them, telling them to scrape off the wax, and that they would find writing on the wood. Following her advice, they found it and read it, and then sent it on to the rest of the Greeks. This is how, it is said, these things happened.